There are times when you're going through something challenging, and other people can tell you're going through something challenging, and they just know something's different, right? And so they look at you, they're like, "Hey, something's going on. What's happening with you?" And you're like, "Oh, you want to hear about it?" And like, "Oh, yeah, sure. Try me." Like, you won't understand. And so they say, "You know, just try me." And so you start to share a little bit about what you're going through, maybe not a lot, but certainly a little. And maybe you're sharing something about a family, you know, stress or strain that you're dealing with. Maybe you start talking about maybe, you know, some of the anxiety or depression that you're dealing with. Or maybe it's about, you know, this question or doubt with your faith. And as you start to share some of this information, the other person's ears perk up a little bit. So perhaps that they can relate to something that you have been through based on something in their own experience. So maybe you say something about a family situation, like, you know, we had this, you know, horrible family feud a couple years ago, and this is what happened. Or maybe you're talking about depression or anxiety, like, you know what, I just want to let you know that I've been to the dark place, and this is what my experience was. Or maybe you start talking about a doubt or a question with your faith, and you're like, you know what, I had this certain struggle a couple years ago, and I did this, and this is what kind of gave me some light at the end of that tunnel for me. So in that scenario, a couple things happen. So first of all, your own ears probably perk up a little bit because we tend to be more receptive to hear things and wisdom and advice and thoughts from people who have kind of been through something similar to us, right? And here's the other thing. My guess is that other person who's been sharing this with you, well, listening to you and then saying, "Hey, I've been through something similar," they're probably more motivated to help you because they themselves have been through something similar. They know how difficult and hard it is. And so they would love to see you get through the other side of that hardship, whatever it might happen to be, right? I was in the fellowship hall after service having some coffee a couple years ago. Friends, we will get back there one day. We're not there yet. Man, that coffee and the cookies are going to taste so good. Okay. Anyway, so we were talking with some parents, and we were talking about something, and talking about their kids, and it was kind of small talk, and then the one parent disclosed that their child was having a certain difficulty in the playground, and so the other parent, you know, realized, wait a second, our child was through something similar a couple years ago, and all of a sudden, small talk turned to meaningful talk, and they started to talk about, okay, what did you do, and they had this shared connection all of a sudden, and there are some times when a shared sorrow leads to a shared solution, and they were talking about that, right? So, having said that, over these past two sermons, we've been focusing on the divinity of Jesus, but today we focus on the humanity of Jesus. And why is that important? Well, someone who has been there, like you, will be there for you. Someone who has been there, like you, will be there, like you. And that person is Christ. And so, have you ever struggled with aloneness? Have you ever struggled, you know, maybe with your sense of identity? Who you are. You're not confident in that. Have you ever had some temptation that you're struggling with and seems to overwhelm you? Well, enter Christ as we come to learn about him in the book of Hebrews. Okay, so before we get into the text, let me do a quick review. I'm not going to show the video review from the past couple weeks, but I will give you verbally kind of just so we're all on the same page again. So Hebrews, most likely written in the early to mid-60s, to a group of Christians who most likely had a Jewish or Hebrew background, so they're very familiar with the Old Testament, growing through some persecution and hardship, most likely under the Roman Emperor Claudius. And so they're going through this, and because they're feeling, you know, their foundations are kind of shaken, they've lost confidence in their leader. And part of the reason that's a problem is because when you lose confidence in the leader, you lose courage for the battle. Like, oh, maybe Jesus isn't the source of blessing, strength, hope, and wisdom that we thought he was because we're going through this stuff. And so the writer of the book of Hebrews, it's technically anonymous, but he writes to them to clarify, okay, this is who Jesus is. Jesus is everything he said he was, everything the scripture says he was. And so they're giving them confidence and clarity so they can face that battle with more courage, okay? So we've been talking about the past two Sundays, the divinity of Jesus. He is the radiance of the glory of God, the exact representation of his being, as we were reminded in chapter 1, verse 3. And today we're going to focus on his humanity and why that is so important, okay? So we're beginning chapter 2, verse 5, and I'm going to go through the NIV and explain some things as we go through. It is not to angels that he has subjected the world to come, about which we are speaking. So, pause. So we're kind of coming in kind of midstream in this longer argument about angels. And as you recall from last week, part of the issue is most likely, we are assuming this from the context, is that because these people have been doubting the sufficiency and superiority of Jesus to give them the help, blessing, and wisdom of God, they're thinking, well, maybe, you know, he died that bloody death on a cross. Maybe he's not all he's cracked up to be. Maybe we should be venerating angels and seeking them for the wisdom, counsel, and providence of God. Like, they're kind of, they've lost their thinking a little bit. And so the author is writing to correct their thinking. It's not to angels that he has subjected the world to come. In other words, in that world to come where everything is fulfilled and earth and heaven meet and every tear is wiped away from every eye, angels aren't in charge of that. Jesus is. Verse 6, but there is a place where someone has testified. We know it's Psalm 8. What is mankind that you are mindful of them? A son of man that you care for him. You made them a little lower than the angels. You crown them with glory and honor and put everything under their feet. Apostle, this is a quote from Psalm 8, as you recall. So I think this is about humans generally, but about Jesus specifically. And Jesus uses the title Son of Man most frequently for himself. But I think what's happening here is we're being reminded that humans, we are made in the image of God, Genesis 1:27. We also have dominion in the world. We are given a certain oversight, stewardship function in the world, Genesis 1:28. Made a little lower than the angels, you crown them with glory and honor, made in his image, put everything under their feet, and putting everything under them, God left nothing that is not subject to them. Yet at present, we do not see everything subject to them. But we do see Jesus, who was made lower than the angels for a little while, now crowned with glory and honor because he suffered death so that by the grace of God he might taste death for everyone. Pause. So I think what's happening here is that these people are doubting Jesus because they saw him die this what seemed to be a shameful death on the cross, bloody and everything. Isn't he really a failure because he came to this, you know, horrible end? So they're seeing that. They're failing to see the significance. They're failing to see the resurrection and the power in the resurrection. And so they're like, they're doubting him because of that. But what we're being told here is that things aren't always as they seem. There was something higher, bigger, greater to what was going on with Jesus on the cross. So imagine you're standing at your front door of your house, and someone comes and knocks on the door, and they're covered in muck and grime, okay? They're filthy. And you're like, oh, wow, like, that, like, couldn't you put something nicer on and like totally covered in muck? And you think, oh, maybe this person isn't someone I want to associate with. But then you learn the backstory. And the backstory is this. That person has just been out in the woods. And they heard a child calling from someplace. And they followed the voice. And they realized this little toddler down in this old abandoned well. And so this person, at great risk to themselves, went down, rescued this toddler, came up, got covered in muck and grime in the process, delivers him back to his parents, and he's a hero. Well, all of a sudden, the muck and grime you actually see is a source of honor, not dishonor, because they have done this great thing. That's kind of a similar thing to what's happening here with Jesus, okay? Tasted death so that by the grace of God he might taste death for everyone. He's doing this for us. Verse 10, in bringing many sons and daughters to glory, it was fitting that God, for whom and through whom everything exists, should make the pioneer of their salvation perfect through what he suffered. Okay, I just love this title, pioneer. Pioneer for Jesus. Other translations might use different words here as they try to translate this Greek word. The King James Version says captain. I like pioneer. There's something about a pioneer. Think of a pioneer, right? For those of us from Ontario, probably know something about pioneers. We even study it in school. A pioneer kind of blazing their trail through the wilderness, you know, making the way. They don't have creature comforts. They're, you know, they're facing the elements, right? And for the benefit of the rest of us. Well, this is like the term pioneer applied to Jesus. He's got the hatchet of righteousness, and he's cutting through the wilderness of sin, death, darkness, evil, making a path for the rest of us back into the heavenly heart and home of God our Father. Pioneer. Verse 11, both the one who makes people holy, Jesus, and those who are made holy are of the same family. He's making us holy. Same family. That doesn't mean we're perfect. It means that we are set apart for a special godly purpose. And Jesus does this for us. And we are put as a part of the same family. So Jesus is not ashamed to call them, us, brothers and sisters. He says, and there's a series of quotes. First one's from Psalm 22, and the second two are from Isaiah 8. And the function of these is to highlight the closeness, the kinship, the family ties. I will declare your name to my brothers and sisters. In the assembly, I will sing your praises. And again, I will put my trust in him. And again, he says, here I am, the children God has given me. Right, so this is a family tie bond. Think of this for a second. We're being spoke of in family terms with Jesus. He looks at us and calls us brother and sister. Like, that's amazing. Brother and sister, right? There's a special family bond. As you know, we moved recently and we were walking down this street and someone, he was so friendly, came out of the house, his own house, saw us walking by with the dog and said, oh, hey, you're the Rattans, right? Yeah. Oh, you know, I don't want this to sound weird, but I looked you up on Facebook, and you're a pastor at that Westminster church. I'm like, yeah. He says, hey, I'm a Christian too. I go to church such and such. I'm like, oh, that's great. So, you know, and I said to him, man, now not only do I have a new neighbor, but I have a new brother. And we gave each other a germ-friendly fist pump. You know, there is something special and close about being a part of the family. Not only that, but Jesus says here, he's not ashamed of us. Not ashamed. Can we just think of this for a second? Like, if there's anybody, anywhere, or anytime who has reason to be ashamed of us, because he's perfect and we are not, like, he is eminently qualified, but he is not ashamed of us. Think of something in your past, you know, someone, you know, you ever felt like you didn't want to be associated with someone because of their reputation, and you're kind of ashamed maybe to be seen with them? Maybe if other people see us together, it's like their reputation will rub off and scuff my reputation. Now think of everything you've done which has ever transgressed the law of God, the commands of God, the teachings of Jesus, things you've done, things you've thought in the past, present, and future. And Jesus looks at us and is not ashamed. He has such love and care for us. He puts such love and value on us that we should have incredible love and value for him. Okay? Verse 14, since the children have flesh and blood, he too shared in their humanity, our humanity, so that by his death he might break the power of him who holds the power of death, that is, the devil, and free those who all their lives were held in slavery by their fear of death. Right, so Jesus comes to do for us what we can't do for ourselves. For surely it is not angels he helps, but Abraham's descendants, you know, children of the covenant, children of God, that's us. For this reason, he had to be made like them, fully human in every way, in order that he might become a merciful and faithful high priest in service of God, and that he might make atonement for the sins of the people. Because he himself suffered when he was tempted, he is able to help those who are being tempted. Okay, so a couple things about that. He comes to do for us as our wonderful, incredible older sibling that we cannot do for ourselves. So not only crushing death, you know, death is no longer a permanent separator from us in the love and embrace of God because of what Jesus has done for us. Not only that, but he crushes the fear of death. John Calvin remarks, fear of death, he defines it as the constant anxiety in which unhappy souls are imprisoned. Fear of death, the constant anxiety in which unhappy souls are imprisoned. He destroys that. And we are his siblings. So he comes along as the older brother in the family, the oldest sibling. I just love this image. Like, across the nation right now, there are older siblings coming to the defense of younger siblings on playgrounds. That's, you know, in an ideal situation, that's what happens, right? And they see someone, you know, picking on their younger sibling, younger brother or sister. And so the older brother or sister comes like, hey, don't do that, right? And so I like this image because Jesus, you know, you know, on the spiritual battleground of life, on the spiritual playground of life, he is coming to our defense, you know, in the context of spiritual warfare. He is coming to do that for us. And then he's also called high priest. Now, specifically called high priest only in the book of Hebrews, but a full 10 times. So what is that? Think of a priest. So a priest ideally serves as the go-between between the people and God and stands before God on behalf of the people. Remember all those passages in the Old Testament, like Old Testament sacrifice? So, you know, it's like the blood of the animals represents the blood of the people. And so this is to bring back this peace and forgiveness between the people of God. So this is the function that Jesus has. He's this mediator, and he himself becomes the sacrifice on our behalf. It's this beautiful gift he does. And not only that, but he is merciful and faithful in the process. So he's not just like punching the clock, reading from a script. I can't wait for 5 o'clock so I can go watch the last couple innings of the Jays game. He is faithful and merciful as our high priest before God, and he makes atonement. So there's been a lot of ink spilled about the meaning of this word atonement in the New Testament. And I just want to share something that I think was particularly helpful that I came across is, you know, it means forgiveness or reconciliation, kind of a coming back together. Something has been atoned for. In a really influential theological book, J.I. Packer says that one of the things we have lost is that, you know, in the use of this word atonement, it's like pacifying the wrath of God. So God is angry, wrathful at sin, right? And so God has this wrath, but this has to be dealt with somehow. So Jesus takes that wrath onto himself in our place, wrath that is otherwise destined for us as people who break his commands and his laws and act selfishly. And so how many of us have seen a movie, right, where there's a train barreling down the tracks, and up on the tracks it's mangled a little bit, and so wreckage is going to occur if someone doesn't divert this train onto another track. And so some hero comes up the last minute to the junction, pulls the railway switch, and train gets diverted. Everything's okay. Well, if you imagine that train barreling down the track is the wrath of God towards sin, Jesus comes up to that junction, pulls the switch, and it's headed towards us, by the way, pulls the switch, diverts that wrath away, and receives it himself on our behalf. This is the great, wonderful love that God has for us. What wondrous love is this? Okay. And then last verse, because he himself suffered when he was tempted. When was Jesus tempted? Well, Matthew 4, by the devil in the wilderness, one of the places. He is able to help those who are being tempted because he knows what it is like. And we end the text for the day there. This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. Okay, so a couple of things here. So someone who has been there like you will be there for you, as I've said, right? He will be there for you in your hardships and temptations. We have to remember this, and this is part of the significance of the humanity of Jesus. Have you ever been in pain? So has Jesus. Have you ever faced criticism? So has Jesus. Have you ever wept when a loved one has died? So has Jesus. Have you ever been mocked? So has Jesus. Have you ever been abandoned? So has Jesus. Have you ever faced evil direct on and been invited to abandon God? So has Jesus. He has walked a mile in your shoes, and even more so. Because of this, and because he has been there, he will be there for you. You can count on him. Think of all that we've described about everything he's done for us. Do you think that type of a person is easily thrown off from helping us? No. He's not easily thwarted if he's done all that for us. Verse 18 says, because he himself suffered when he was tempted, he is able to help those who are being tempted. But how? How specifically? We're just going to highlight three things. These are three helps for weary souls, I'm calling them. The first is quite simply that you are not alone. Jesus walks beside you. Jesus assures us that suffering is not a sign of rejection by God. Jesus himself suffered through life. Does that mean that God had fully and finally rejected him? No, think of all the good that came through him. You know what, something that happens sometimes is we see someone else who's suffering and we think, oh, you know, they're going through really hardship. I wonder if they're in that moment thinking that God has rejected them, because you know what, if we're faithful and we read our Bible sometimes, that means that right, God is always finally and fully blessing us in a way that we understand, and life should be lattes and kittens and rainbows and beach time all the time, right? No. And then you talk to those people who are experiencing hardship, and although never good, and I would never, you know, wish hardship on anyone, quite often those people say after some time has passed and then, you know, the rearview mirror of their mind's eye, they say, you know what, it was really hard, but I know that during that time I felt closer to God than I ever felt before, or I have become stronger than I ever could have anticipated. Verse 9, he suffered death so that by the grace of God he might taste death for everyone. He suffered death? Seems like a very hard thing, but what a blessing for the rest of us. Someone who has been there like you will be there for you. And that's Jesus. Second, Jesus gives you a firm identity. And this is so important. Your status as a child of God is not contingent on what you have or haven't done, but what on Jesus has done. And this is so great. You're not defined by a sin. You're not defined by a sin. You're defined by a Savior. No sin that you have committed, are committing, or will commit is bigger than the forgiveness of God in Jesus. How wonderful. Thank you, God, for that incredible gift. This isn't license to go out and do whatever we want. We want to be growing in faithfulness, but our identity as a child of God is secure in him. All that stuff about children of God, family of God, same family, brother and sister, that's what this is about, identity. Who are you? You're a child of God. That's who you are. Now, there's so much stuff out there about identity in our culture, right? Oh, you just make up who you are and this or that or whatever. Maybe it's something someone heard at university or saw on YouTube or whatever. There's all this stuff. And I get that, you know, people want to have a say in their identity, and that's good to a certain degree. But what I see happening is because so much stuff is flimsy or just made up or whatever, just in response to our feelings, whatever they happen to be, it's like people, they base their identity, their lives on this. And then what happens, as soon as it's pushed or tested a little bit, everything crumbles and falls apart because they've been building their lives on this identity, which isn't real. And so Jesus gives you a firm, not a flimsy, identity as one of his children. When you know who you are, no matter what, you can have confidence no matter what. When you know who you are, no matter what, as a child of God, you can have confidence no matter what. Someone who's been there, like you, will be there for you. Third and finally, Jesus shows you escape from temptation. Right? He was like us in every way. However, chapter 4 says, yet without sin. So although he had experienced this temptation, he never succumbed to this temptation. So he's the one who can show us a way out of it, which is great for us because temptation in various ways, whether it's a certain sin, maybe it's a thought, maybe it's a behavior, whatever it happens to be, it's something we struggle with, but he's the one who shows us the exit ramp. In 1 Corinthians 1:13, Paul says it like this, no temptation has overtaken you, except that which is common to mankind, meaning, you know, you've dealt with it, other people have dealt with it. And God is faithful. He will not let you be tempted beyond what you can bear. It's good news. But when you are tempted, he will also provide a way out so that you can endure it. A way out. Imagine you're lost in the forest. And it's getting dark, and you're like, oh man, I'm going to be back by 8 or whatever. And you're lost. You know, this is a huge forest. And you see someone up by this clump of pine trees up there, and you're like, hello. And they're like, hello. And you're like, I'm lost. Can you help me get out of here? Like, come on, come up, follow me. And so they get up there and start walking. Like, oh, I'm so glad I ran into you. This is so great. are you sure you can get us out of the forest? And they're like, no. Like, what do you mean? I'm lost too. What did you tell me that you could lead me out of the forest if you are lost too? Jesus is the only one who actually can lead us forward. He is the way and the truth and the life because he dealt with temptation, but he never succumbed to it. So he actually knows the way. So how do we do this? Well, let me give you three little bits, and there's way more to say on this than these three points, but I'll tell them. First of all is to pray to God about it. Sometimes we have these temptations and struggles, and it's like we want to hide them for God as if God doesn't know. And so we don't talk to him about it. We don't ask his spirit to guide us out of them. Second, we study the teachings of Jesus. Because if Jesus is the one who is fully human like us in every way, yet without sin, and resisted temptation, so his teachings, therefore, are going to be the pathway to a better place. He leads us from the path of faithlessness to the path of faithfulness, right? And the third is really critical. Talk to other godly people who are on the path. Talk to other godly people who you know who are walking the path, who maybe have struggled with similar things, who are faithful in their journey and are a little different on the place on the path than you. Talk to them. Someone who has been there, like you, will be there for you. First, Jesus walks beside you, friends. Two, Jesus gives you a firm identity. Three, Jesus shows you escape from temptation. Final thought. There's a missionary who, this is told in his book, Give Them Christ by Stephen Siemens. Missionary, he goes to this foreign land and He just wants to share the love and the message and the mission of Jesus with these people, and a really helpful, lovely person. But he's there and he's feeling like after years he's not making any headway. He's not feeling like he's making progress, and it's like the locals just they're not listening to him. They don't feel like he's one of them. He's not like them, and so he's struggling and he's dealing with these frustrations and. Unfortunately, his son got sick. He was there with his family, and his young son got sick. And one day, his son got this fever that went out of control and died. It's horrible. So not only are you dealing with a child dying, which is just unimaginable, but also you're so far from home. And so he makes this little casket for his own son, and he goes out to bury his son in the casket one day, and the locals are kind of from a distance. They're watching to see what's going to happen. And so he's there, and he's digging the hole in the ground with a shovel. And as he's doing so, he's audibly weeping, and he's crying, and his own tears are going down on this casket that he's made for his own son. And the locals are saying to themselves, look, he cries just like us. He's like us. He cries just like us. And from that day forward, things were different. They were more receptive to who he was and what he had to say, and they journeyed forward together. Someone who has been there like you will be there for you, and for us, that person is Jesus. Thanks be to God for his radiance. Amen.